Welcome. I'm so happy to be here with you today, discussing this such an important topic. So we're discussing today challenges, opportunities, and practical insights related to the AI Act. And I want to start with Luca. From your perspective, during the latest months of the negotiation, what were the most challenging issues, more from the negotiation aspect?
Thank you, Luisa. Yes, indeed. I mean, I've been in Brussels following the process the entire time. And yeah, some people would joke that I was hiding in the meeting room sometimes. Yeah, so I would say, you know, first of all, just to give you a sense of where this is coming from. When the AI Act was first proposed, the overall mood was like, this was a premature proposal, that the technology was not mature yet, and so the commission was jumping the gun, basically. Then after the public release of ChatGPT, AI became such a hype that the mood became, you know, you're too slow, this is going too fast, and so on and so forth. So it's not only the fact that people like to complain, but also it shows the limits of trying to regulate a technology that moves such a pace that you have a new generation every few months. So indeed, I would say the most challenging moment was the realization that ChatGPT and the underlying foundation model basically didn't fit in the AI Act. I mean, if you talk to the commission, they would tell you, yeah, but we have some transparency for chatbots. I doubt that would have been considered, sufficient by anyone involved. So, you know, for how much the commission said the proposal was future-proof, well, it didn't even last the time of the negotiations. And I think that the European Parliament, you know, it took them more time to find their position, but I think they actually developed a much more comprehensive approach to foundation models and managed to get their basic idea through. I think that the most challenging moment was probably when the negotiations went very close to breaking down, when you had this technical meeting and basically the Spanish presidency said that they had no mandate to negotiate on foundation models because France, Germany, and Italy didn't want any hard rules for foundation models because of the startups you were mentioning before, in particular Mistral AI, to a lesser extent Aleph Alpha. So I think that there we really saw different interests collide. You have the interest of the commission, the parliament that had, political pressure to reach an agreement, also the presidency, of course, before the elections, because they didn't want to miss this window of opportunity to come forward with this first regulation in the world on artificial intelligence. And of course, politicians, especially before elections, they need victories to bring to their constituencies to get reelected, to get reappointed, and so on. And on the other hand, you had some private actors that, you know, pushed their domestic governments toward their interest. And their interest was, of course, not to have rules in these specific sectors, saying that, you know, compared to other sectors, the European companies still had a chance to compete with big tech. So I would say this was possibly the most delicate moment. You also had a very delicate one during the last trilogue itself on law enforcement, when everyone was really exhausted. They had been negotiating for I think close to 24 hours straight. And, you know, I think that everyone was really nervous. Attention was through the roof. And at the end, they called for a recess. And I think that was probably the good call to make, since all, you know, policymakers are humans, not AI, so they also need rest. So
you made a great impression, right, on all of us. We saw the pictures, like they were hours and hours. So for everyone that said that the European bureaucrats don't work, so that picture showed that at least with this topic, they are working hard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, this comes back to the political pressure and time pressure. And I think, you know, probably then we'll come to the final text later on. But I think that probably that played an important role in how the AI Act landed, because there was a political need to find an agreement by December if they didn't want to miss this opportunity. And, you know, with a new mandate, you never know what happens. So.
And as you were hiding in the meeting rooms, I'm kidding. So as you were paying attention to the discussions and the details of these discussions, do you think that the members of the European Parliament, they have technical knowledge? What did you feel? The discussions, there were all the time, there were technical people involved?
Well, you know, this is a technology where you have very few experts. Well, a lot of improvised experts, but not so many actual experts. And especially elected officials like MEPs, they are not elected for their technical knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. They are elected because they represent their constituents. So I think it took some time for all institutions to build up expertise in this area, just because it was completely new for everyone to regulate. I know a few experts that were in the background indeed advising, and, you know, like actively also during the negotiations. I know of professors or also NGOs that were advising on the more technical level. I would say in their European Parliament, they probably started their work early with the AIDA committee, this ad hoc committee that was set up 2019, I think, something like that. For the Commission, it was the white paper. So, you know, there was some preparatory work. So the AI Act didn't drop from the sky from one day to another.
Good. Interesting. So as we were talking about professors and law, so I want to ask a question to Professor Gianclaudio. I want to hear from you a little bit about your research, if you want to explain to the audience, for those that are not familiar. So why explainability and transparency in the context of AI, and especially in the context of general purpose AI systems, so ChatGPT, why people need to know it? Or is it possible? Aren't we pushing it too much and actually it's not possible? So why do these obligations matter?
Great. Thank you so much, Luisa, for this opportunity, for this question also. So, of course, it's not easy to answer, but I can give, of course, my two cents on the topic. And I agree with you that, and with Luca, that, you know, the efforts towards a human-centric approach to the AI Act was meaningful, in particular in the second half of the negotiations. And, yeah, you mentioned some important elements there. You mentioned the explainability requirements that now we have for high-risk AI systems. I would like just to connect this with what was before the AI Act. In Europe, we have the GDPR, and there was a lot of emphasis on Article 22 of the GDPR, which is the right not to be subject to automated decisions, and the connected rights of individuals to have a human in the loop in case decisions are automated and have significant or similarly significant effect on individuals. Then they have, or the right to contestation, right to express one's view. Connected to this, there was a right to know the logic of algorithms. But this duty was just for data controllers. Data controllers are usually just what in the AI Act are the deployers. So the users, like my university using AI on students, God no, but or whatever, the law enforcement authority. Well, law enforcement are not under the GDPR, but under the law enforcement directive. You know, companies that use AI, so they can somehow give some logic about the reasoning. About the decision making system. But now the AI Act is covering the gap between the producer of AI, who are the ones that know, and should know, at least, or should control, or should have a yes or no decision on whether we want to go on some unexplored, impossible black box or white box systems. So the gap from them, from there to the users of AI systems. I think we needed this step. We needed to impose the duties of explainability on the AI provider, the AI producers, the AI designers, however we want to call them, to make meaningful, to make use of Article 22 of the GDPR, of a possible right to explanation with all the limits of explanation. So this is important in terms of stakeholders and in terms of scope. And I think this was this was something very, very important. Then you asked about generative AI. Well, for generative AI, this was also very interesting in terms of policymaking. From the very initial proposal of the commission, we know that general purpose AI, generative AI, was not in the proposal. But then the political pressure, the media, the release of ChatGPT in November 22 raised the issue of this urgency. We needed to do something, right? And it's super interesting because if the EU policymaking would be quicker, we wouldn't have the opportunity to add general purpose AI regulation in the law, because actually this was added after 1 year and a half from the first proposal of the European Commission. In other ways, we could say that this law is, in general, AI laws are intrinsically non-technologically neutral, because they need to look at what's happening in the last years. But I think the AI Act is wise in that respect, because it's identifying the issue of general purpose AI, it was not too late to do that, and then putting some predictability requirements. And this is something important. All the critics to the AI Act say, well, let's say critic from right wing are saying, well, we shouldn't regulate because it's impossible, because we don't know, because we cannot predict, etc., right? But the point is that the AI Act is giving predictability to what is permitted and to what is not permitted. Generative AI had already been prohibited in Europe, but at national levels. We saw the example of Italy with the Garante, Data Protection Authority, that a couple of years ago decided to block ChatGPT, also for the transparency elements. So they had several conditions and lists on why ChatGPT should have been blocked in Italy. One was about children, another was about transparency and also understandability, and also the enforcement of some data protection rights, like right to accuracy, erasure, etc. So in that respect, I think now the AI Act is saying general purpose AI, of course, well, there's no prejudice to the GDPR. So if there are data protection problems, okay, data protection authorities can regulate, can decide, can block, can give sanction. Still, we now know that if general purpose AI respect the systemic risk assessment duties and the transparency duties that are in the special parts of general purpose AI chapter in the AI Act, they can release, they can use, they can commercialize the system. So yeah, and why is it important to know and to understand? I think one thing we should look at, and then I will conclude, is not just technical transparency. Technical transparency is super important. The other step is critical transparency. Now I'm citing Mireille Hildebrandt. She wrote 12 years ago about critical transparency as the right to know the risks, the right to know the implications. So what I think this human-centered regulation from the GDPR to the AI Act are trying to do is we don't need to know just how the black box works, but the impacts that this black box have on fundamental rights, on society, on human rights. So maybe the black box cannot be opened, but the effects of this black box, how this black box affects other things, impacts other things, this can be seen and can be prevented. So there are some systems that cannot be explained, but all business models can be mitigated and explained.
Thank you so much. And I want to follow up also now with another question. So Article 29A of the AI Act establishes fundamental rights impact assessments for high-risk AI systems. So deployers have to perform this FRIA, right? The acronym, fundamental rights impact assessment, before they deploy a high-risk AI. So I want to ask you, how do you see this impact assessment? So do you think it will be effective? And it has a big name, right? Fundamental rights. So the way it was legislated, so the way the text is written, do you think it's what you were expecting? So you were one of the scholars that were fighting for it, and you were asking for more protection. The final text, do you think it helps protect people, or just kind of it was diluted and not so helpful?
Thank you so much for this question. I think it's, of course, it's one of the topics closest to my heart. So I think just to rapidly respond to this, I will try to be super brief. It was introduced by the European Parliament amendments, and then it was negotiated. There were some turbulences in the last months. Luca knows more about that because we were reading from his articles. And the council, the Spanish council, was proposing a mediation because the council, the Spanish presidency of the council was proposing some mediations, in particular because the idea that the council and the commission had was that this FRIA was redundant. Because you already have some impact assessment. For example, you have the data protection impact assessment, or you have, for social media, for example, you have already fundamental right impact assessment in the DSA, in the Digital Services Act, Article 34. So this was this idea that was redundant. So they wanted to limit it to public authorities and not to private authorities. And also they want to make it mostly voluntary. So there was this final, fight. NGOs helped a lot to advocate for this. And also scholars, as you said, we launched with the Brussels Privacy Hub, we launched a letter from 150 professors signing for a meaningful fundamental right impact assessment. But what is the final text, the final compromise? So we are happy that it's not just for public authorities. It's also for private authorities, but just if they serve public functions. And then in the recital, it's explained that public functions can be hospitals, can be education. So this is good. And it applies to banks and insurances also explicitly. So this is also very good. The idea is that if you limit FRIA just to public authorities, you are losing most of the problems, right? Because you're missing the point, because we know that our fundamental rights are at risk for also in relationship and mostly to private companies, when we are consumers, when we are customers, etc. So that is very good. What is not so good is that something was moved to the recital. The first thing is participatory approach. We really need that this FRIA have the participation of impactor stakeholders. This is still there, but just as a recommendation in the recital, not in the body of the article. So this is a bit disappointing. The other thing is that while in the DSA, for social media, the FRIA, the Fundamental Right Impact Assessment, should be every year, so it should be regular, on a regular basis. Here, in the AI Act, they say that this regularity, the cyclic nature of FRIA, is just when risks change, when the level of risk change. So it's kind of arbitrarious cycling timeline. But I think I will stop now.
So I want to ask a question to Risto now. So Risto is a researcher, and you recently published, Risto, the EU Commission Manifesto, where you talk about recommendations for the next EU mandate. I think it's very timely and important. So I would like you to share a bit with the audience. I'm not sure if everyone is aware, so please share a little bit about it. And from your point of view, what are the most important recommendations and why they matter?
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Actually, it's interestingly, it's my birthday today. And what a great way to have, celebrate my birthday with you having talking about one of the first ever major comprehensive AI regulations in the world, right? So thanks a lot for having me. Yeah, thank you. Before I respond to your question, I want to go very briefly back to what both Luca and Gian Claudio mentioned around general purpose AI and the kind of political process around it. I want to push back a little bit or like kind of add some nuances to this this discussion. So the European Commission initially released the AI Act draft back in April 2021, and external stakeholders were asked for input in August 2021. So a lot of like over 300 different stakeholders submitted feedback to the European Commission. Actually, already in November 2021, when Slovenia was leading the council presidency, they already introduced an article titled General Purpose AI Systems. That was already before the end of 2021. And then in May 2022, France, which was then leading the European, the Council of the EU, they made very significant changes to that specific article. They actually asked very meaningful requirements from the developer of general purpose AI systems. And now think about when ChatGPT was released, November 2022. So actually, over a year of discussion around general purpose AI systems already happened. Not all of that was around, you know, very large scale language models or anything like that. It was all kinds of other types of systems that were included in the general purpose AI system category. But actually, people should give a little bit more credit to the EU institutions and the policymakers, because like arguably they actually did foresee some of those things based on also the input of, I don't know, academics and civil society and other stakeholders, of course. But yeah, it's not exactly true that ChatGPT came and, you know, completely destroyed the regulation, even though it did, of course, have a major impact, no doubt about that. But anyway, just wanted to like add that nuance to the discussion. Coming back to the topic or the question you asked, yes, we recently submitted or published an EU Commission manifesto, and we had something like, you know, seven or so recommendations there, but maybe the key ones that I would highlight is one is really ensure that the EU AI office, which is a new regulatory body that the AI Act set up, is robust and has the ability to perform various tasks that it has been set to do. This is no small feat, because the number of tasks that they have is actually quite significant. They have to monitor the regulation, how well the regulation is working. They have to try to enforce it. They have to coordinate between member states. They have the whole general purpose AI systemic risk designation issue and topic. They have a lot of different tasks. And the AI office plans to hire up to 80 people over the next year or so, together with 20 people from the European Commission, up to 100 staff. So compared to, for example, the UK AI Safety Institute, which has been working for the last year or so already, they are at a very early stage. And I would recommend them to, you know, make sure that they are in touch with the UK AI Safety Institute, learn everything that they are doing, make sure that they have enough money to hire the best people to carry out these tasks. It's going to be a huge challenge. Second thing we recommended was actually, you know, continuing developing this regulatory package around digital technologies. So the current European Commission, or soon to be the previous one, started the AI Liability Directive, which should be continued. They should finish this. And arguably, it was put on pause exactly for the reason that the AI Act would finish, and then the Liability Directive would, people could make sure that it's quite aligned with the AI Act. So why is it necessary? Well, the EU AI Act mostly talks about ex-ante requirements, so requirements for companies before they put something to the market. And hopefully that will reduce risks, right? But it's not guaranteed that even if they follow the AI Act to the letter, that they will avoid all kinds of damages and incidents. It's not guaranteed. And if a damage or some kind of harm occurs, who is liable? Who should bear the costs? Who should, you know, support those who have been harmed? I think it's very crucial to finish that legislative document as well. And then finally, there's a mechanism called the codes of practices for general purpose AI. And these are essentially, you know, guidelines or documents that companies can follow to show compliance with the Act, especially when it comes to general purpose AI tools or systems before technical standards are developed for those kinds of models and systems. And we think it's extremely important that those are drafted with the inclusion of civil society. Companies, industry oftentimes has a lot of power over technical standards, these guidelines, and for good reasons, but civil society has very strong advantages that they can add. For example, they don't have commercial interest. They're interested in the public good, how well AI systems work for the whole society. And they could bring that perspective and make sure that the industry doesn't, you know, only serve their own interest. And sometimes they can also bring a lot of expertise that maybe industry doesn't have. So yeah, those would be the main things that I would highlight from all the 7 recommendations that we have. People can look up our document and, you know, look for other types of recommendations there.
So now let's move to a more dynamic part of the session today. So I want to hear from each of you a little bit from the same topic. So from each of your perspective, when do you see the final text of the EU AI Act? What are the most problematic issues and why? So let's start with Luca.
Well, that's easy. I'll give you only one typos. I was actually at an event with some lawyers a few weeks ago, and one of them told me it's incredible that they would publish a law with typos. From a lawyer perspective, this makes their job so much easier because, yeah, you know, if you take the part on open source software, it says the opposite of what is the legislator meant to say. And, you know, if you have a text that is not polished, unclear, it's very easy for companies and lawyers to go around it to get it dismissed in court. So, you know, I think that the highest price that the political momentum had to pay for the AI Act was the quality of the text. So the lawyer linguists are meant to polish the text. Let's see if they do some miracles. Huh? But I think there are parts of the text that cannot be fixed. If you take Article 6, it's a mess. I would challenge anyone to say they have a solid legal case to use the filtering conditions of Article 6. I think, you know, the text is so uncertain. Only if you are a rich company, you take the risk to get fined afterwards. So, you know, I think on certain parts, the text is truly self-defeating, and that the overall quality, even by the admission of people that have been involved, it's quite low.
Thank you, Luca. So, Gianclaudio?
Yeah, first of all, I would like to say something I was a bit disappointed with is the emotion recognition part. From a legal, ethical perspective, emotion recognition is one of the most problematic and intrusive things. Maybe as an initial disclaimer to this answer, before I dive into the emotion recognition thing, I see this was a huge effort. It started as a safety, like product safety instrument, and now it's a fundamental rights general regulation. So it was huge, and it's normal that we have typos, we have problems, because of course it was huge with so many stakeholders, such an intense. I think it was the longest or one of the longest trialogues ever, one of the longest list of amendments ever, more than the GDPR. Much more, and the GDPR was the unprecedented case. And also about the general purpose AI development, as Risto was saying, just to clarify on that, yes, the Slovenian presidency had already advanced this, but now it's a new treaty on generative AI because we have 6 articles, you know, just to say how it grew. Okay, but something could have been done better in terms of emotion recognition, as I was saying. In the initial proposal of the commission, emotion recognition was considered limited risk. And of course, it's crazy, right? It shouldn't be limited. It's very problematic. The parliament had proposed to ban emotion recognition, but there was this discussion that it's a pseudoscience, you are going to limit science, all these discussions, and also the therapeutic use, the anti-suicidal use, etc. Now it has been put as high risk, but a couple of cases, so education and employment, are prohibited. So you cannot detect emotion of in the employment context and in the educational context. So it's why not in other problematic fields? Why not on migration? Why for migration purposes shouldn't we ban emotion recognition? You know, as you said, I've worked a lot on vulnerability, and one of the biggest sources of vulnerabilities being a migrant, facing the challenges of borders, and emotion recognition there, it's extremely problematic. It's high risk now, but it could have been better. Another problem, because you asked two or three bullet points, is the definition of vulnerability. Maybe we can talk. There are lights and shadows. I like the fact that it has been expanded from the commission proposal, because the commission was proposing to ban just vulnerability based on age and disability. Now it's also social and economic conditions, Article 5B. Still, there's something that could have been better included, but maybe in the positive parts, we can say that there is another article that expands this view. Freya, we already mentioned there are some limits for the fundamental right impact assessment, the participation and the periodic timeline. Maybe a last thing that was also criticized a lot by NGOs in the last moment is Article 29 about ex post biometric surveillance. It was something that was added in the very hot discussion about Article 5, so about biometric surveillance. The ex-ante biometric, the real-time biometric surveillance is now more or less limited with several caveats and disclaimers, but the ex-post surveillance is still possible, so the ex-post analysis of biometric things. What we should cherish, what we should treasure, is the data protection laws and data retention laws. So we should now really make sure that this Article 29 will be limited by data protection laws about retention, about the possibility of not processing data beyond purposes, etc.
Yeah, it's interesting this point of view, because if we think of biometric data and in facial recognition, it will be a type of biometrics, then we have at least the GDPR protection, the additional data protection principles and rules. Interesting. Thank you. And Risto?
Yeah, I have a couple of thoughts. So firstly, I think this is a very long and complex regulation, and so we can expect it to be very hard to implement in practice. So I've heard some people make the point in discussions that it is basically like a Christmas tree. Everybody wanted to add something, and it grew and grew, and they got their favorite thing on the tree. For some kind of description of the complexity, or as a proxy for that, the senior policy advisor at the European Parliament, Laura Caroli, she recently compared GDPR and the AI Act on LinkedIn. And according to her, the AI Act has 180 recitals. So recitals are these background text, background information for the specific provisions, compared to GDPR's 173 recitals, so more recitals. It has 113 articles compared to 99 articles in GDPR. And it has 68 definitions compared to 26 definitions in GDPR. And it has 13 annexes and no annexes in GDPR. So, and people complain about how difficult GDPR enforcement has been over the last couple of years. We can expect this to be very challenging for the AI Act as well. I have received tons of comments already from some stakeholders saying, hey, like, it looks good, this AI Act on paper, but like, what does this and that thing actually in practice mean? Like, what should we actually need to do? And my response to them usually is, well, we should wait for the European Commission to develop guidelines. There will be technical standards, codes of practices. Different people will develop new services, but it is going to be challenging, right? Lots of work ahead. And maybe the second thing I would mention is a general purpose AI governance actually in this in this document is quite weak compared to like some versions, some negotiation proposals that were on the table based on some of the leaks that Luca shared and other technology journalists. For example, it completely lacks third-party testing and auditing compared to, like, I saw some version where it was independent testing and red teaming was mentioned. But at the end of the day, providers need to perform model evaluations. For example, general purpose AI with systemic risk, these kinds of model providers, they need to perform model evaluations just internally. Why should we trust what the outcomes of that model evaluation that are coming from the companies? That's significantly weaker than could have been reasonable. And yeah, I'll stop here because we're running out of time soon.
Thank you. So now let's be technology optimist or law-wise optimistic. Is there something to celebrate? So is there what are the positive sides? So Jean-Claude, let's start with you.
Yeah, I am an optimistic person in general. As a lawyer, I try to take the best of what we have. I'm positive about the AI Act. So I must say, I'm reading in the chat, there are different views that no regulation is better than typos or something like that. I think we should keep clear in mind that AI has huge externalities, very high risks, that we cannot just regulate through data protection because data protection is the last part and it depends on many scope problems about scope. We cannot just regulate through the platform problem because AI is affecting also us offline. I was mentioning the border. There were discussion I saw in the chat about the border. Actually, it applies to border. So it's not excluded from the scope, the AI Act, I mean. So what is good? First of all, red flags. We have something that is prohibited, very clear. So what is good, I think, is that the risk analysis is not just left to the autonomy of companies. There is a political decision on what is in the red zone, in the prohibited zone. This is the first time. This is something where the European Union is saying, we, as fundamental right concepts, we set some threshold that cannot be overcome. So this is a first very good thing. Second is the fact that it was moved from a product safety tool to a fundamental right tool. And we mentioned many things about that. The attention to vulnerability, the attention to different levels of risk assessment. There is a risk assessment at the level of deployers, which is the FRIA, and the risk assessment at the level of producers, which is the risk assessment of Article 9. And then we have risk assessment for general purpose AI. It might seem a mess, but actually it's setting important principles. Then we can spend 10 years to implement, but at least we have these principles that courts and regulators can use. And maybe the last thing is that it's the first law that clarifies on some important concepts that were never in a law, like the concept of bias, the concept, again, of general purpose AI, the concept of systemic risk. It's broad principles. There are many vague concepts. But at least for the first time, the law is not based on old concepts that might have problems. If we think at the US systems, even for data protection, they're still based on tort law mostly, or some national laws like California, etc. But can we really, in the age of informational capitalism, base the protection of our data just on tort law? It's the same with AI. Could we just base the protection of fundamental rights in the age of AI just on data protection or platform regulation? Maybe not. So, yeah.
So, Luca?
Thank you. Well, you know, if you look at the status quo, I think indeed the AI Act is an improvement, especially in terms of setting out a framework on how to manage risk and basically to set the boundaries for this new technology and what is allowed and what should not be allowed. I think, though, in terms of legal clarity, which was one of the main reason to present this proposal from the start, I think the legislator could have done a better job. The commission will have to do some heavy lifting in terms of clarifying what the text means in practice with these guidelines and secondary acts. overall, I think the EU has taken a leading role also in terms of prohibited practices and what should be, you know, not allowed to be used. I think what we saw with the Council of Europe, where they proposed that signatories also issue a moratorium on stuff like social scoring, I think this is one of the positive sides of the AI Act. Then, of course, we will see quite significant compliance costs for companies, especially those in the high-risk area. I think that one of the risks we could see from the AI Act is that companies prefer not to go and, you know, create applications in the high-risk area simply because it's more costly for them. But those are actually the areas that might bring the most benefits to society. So, you know, as with everything, it's a bit of a mixed bag. Overall, it's better than what we had before and sets out an horizontal framework for using artificial intelligence that is nowhere to be found at this time in the world. I think that the job is not done. I mean, as we saw with the GDPR, it's the sixth year since the entry into force. We are only starting to see now case law and, you know, international cases being brought forward. So I think for the and let's keep in mind that the GDPR didn't start the process. We had a data protection law and a privacy law before in Europe. The AI Act is completely starting from scratch. So I think this will be a long process. We are talking about 5 to 10 years to see the most concrete effects in terms of shaping this emerging market. And at the same time, I don't think that the job is completely done because this discussion has also shown that there are limits to the AI Act in terms of what it can do for copyrighted material. There will probably be an initiative of the Commission in the next mandate on this. There are already talks to have some other vertical initiatives on AI in the workplace. So I think this will be one of the, you know, this will remain on top of the agenda, both in terms of legislation, but also in terms of enforcement in the next years.
Risto?
Yeah, a few things that are really good in the Act. One is, for example, the innovation measures for SMEs and EU startups. So there's previously, I think it was Article 55, but now after some kind of reordering and renumbering, I think it's Article 62 that talks about specific measures of innovation. So, for example, there will be priority access for SMEs and EU-based startups for regulatory sandboxes. So these are environments where SMEs can, without, you know, serious repercussions necessarily, they can, before they deploy something to the market, they can experiment, get some feedback, some guidance from regulators, from to know that they comply with the AI Act. Also, they hopefully will receive some receive some guidance from to comply with the AI Act generally, and the fees will be reduced for them. The compliance costs will actually be lower thanks to these innovation measures. Is the hope based on this article? Also, the Commission will regularly review whether the how large these costs are for the SMEs and startups to make sure that if it can, they could be reduced if they're too large. So I think that's overall really good. Also, I think somebody mentioned earlier the future-proofness about this regulation. I think everybody, all the policymakers, actually quite carefully considered future-proofing the AI Act, which is partly why it's quite general and vague, because they didn't want to be too specific and be outdated immediately. So there are some instruments that allow the law to be changed. So delegated implementing acts, these kinds of secondary legislation that the Commission can develop. For example, the Commission can change the definition of AI system. They can change the criteria that exempt AI systems from high-risk rules. They can change what is in the higher risk use cases category and what isn't there. They can change thresholds for classifying general purpose AI with systemic risk. Technical documentation, they can change some things there. So yeah, a bunch of things that they can change, which is quite good because AI can advance quite quickly and we need to make update the law to be in line with those changes. Maybe final thing, which maybe not everybody paid attention to, but I thought it was really good. So the AI Act covers the whole value chain better now than the original version did. So the original version kind of focused much more on the deployers of AI systems. But now there's kind of more focus on the range of stakeholders, like the model developers, for example, the initial ones, especially when it comes to general purpose AI. They have a focus as well. The value chain is quite complicated when it comes to AI development. It's kind of like car manufacturing. There's so many different bits and pieces. Everybody has in that value chain some type of strengths and advantages, and they can reduce certain risks and not others. For example, the initial model developer has a much stronger position to share information about the initial model, the training data, perhaps help them. The final deployers comply with the AI Act, whereas the final deployers, they know the use case better. They are very heavily involved with the clients. They know if they want to fine-tune the initial model with their training data, they can curate, make sure that the training data is representative and unbiased and whatnot. So I think that was a really good addition to care about the value chain, make sure that different stakeholders have some obligations in that.
Thank you, Risto. And the AI Act is only the beginning. And in your view, what are the next steps? And also, if you could maybe thinking about the audience, what do you say to the audience? Something that people could do right now, especially those in privacy departments or compliance department. Do you have something like, do you have any recommendations for the audience? So please, Risto.
Sure. I think everybody can contribute to trying to interpret the law in some way. They can try to develop some tools that would help with that. For example, we at the FLI have developed the EU AI Act compliance checker, which is like a very simple tool that people can just use. Companies, organizations can kind of go through a questionnaire and think about, you know, which one applies to them and kind of finally have some indication of whether they would have any legal obligations under the AI Act. It's kind of a tool to help them kind of make sense. Another tool we have developed is the AI Act Explorer, which is basically like a, you know, search tool to check different articles, search for specific things. If you're interested in fundamental rights impact assessment, where exactly is that in the AI Act? Let me just like search it quickly and stuff like that. So I think these kinds of tools, like everybody can contribute in some way. You can just always educate yourself about the AI Act more broadly. But I would give recommendations to kind of all the experts and the policymakers who are involved in this process as well. Yeah, continue working on the AI liability directive. It's very important to finalize, finish that, make sure that we have damages, harms, covered and it's in line with the AI Act and with AI generally. Also make sure that the AI office is as competent as possible, everybody can speak to their machine learning friends, to their legal expert friends, tell them, hey, there's AI office, they're hiring. Maybe you want to contribute to that process. It's like one of a kind institution. And policymakers hopefully will take it seriously and make sure that the budget is serious for this institution. The UK AI Safety Institute has committed, has been able to commit something like £100 million. The EU is still quite vague about how much money they have for this. So that's a very important thing. And maybe finally, I would recommend just kind of to focus on a larger narrative about innovation slightly differently, like reframe the narrative from like, let's increase innovation or that kind of stuff, which is like a very general thing that everybody talks about, oh, AI helps innovation. Let's talk about actual meaningful applications to solve some of the biggest pressing issues. Let's talk about AI for reducing climate change. Make sure like AI contributes to global poverty and things like that. Like, we don't want any kind of AI innovation. maybe we don't want emotion recognition. Maybe we want some other tools, some other products that actually meaningfully help us innovate in the direction that benefits everybody. So yeah, reframe the narrative a bit on innovation.
Thank you, Risto. Gianclaudio?
Yeah, so let's say recommendations, as you said, maybe for the first for the regulator is to really now implement Article 5. Let's understand what's prohibited in practice. And I know they're already working on that. DG Connect is working hard on that. It will be the very first important thing, because it will be the basis of all the other legislation. What's really Article 5.1a, b, c, etc. For companies, the most important thing, in my view, is to first of all taking seriously the other pieces of legislation, making sure that they're, as you said, we already mentioned things that are already there, and if they were taken more seriously, the AI Act would be easier. Privacy by design, impact assessment in different forms we have in the DSA, in the GDPR, etc. If we take these things seriously now, it would be easier to adapt to the AI Act. And for most companies, indeed, the FRIA is the challenge, because they, as users, it's mostly their challenge. So trying to understand how to do impact assessment, building on existing models and connecting the models. Most of the people that will need to do this FRIA have already a data protection impact assessment. That is maybe based on poor reductionist questionnaires based mostly on cybersecurity. We should go to the next step. We should wonder what is impact on fundamental rights. And this will make things easier for the FRIA.
Thank you. Luca?
Thanks. I'll second what was said before on the AI office, and you know, ensure that it's sufficiently staffed and resourced. I mean, if you look at stuff like Article 5 or Annex 3 on the high risk categories, it's clear that these are written in the sand. I mean, they can become out of date very quickly. So the Commission should keep the pulse on where the industry is going and engage with stakeholders, experts, not just as a tick the box exercise, but actually having meaningful exchanges with experts. For the private sector, of course, now everyone is trying to figure out if they fall in the high risk category or not. I cannot tell you that. Of course. What I can tell you is that there will be plenty of B2B services coming your way, and AI safety organizations and so on. So you'll be fully covered. I think there will be a temptation to underestimate risk that should be resisted, especially from startups that need the money now and can risk a fine for later. I think this will be probably punished by investors. So there should be a responsible behavior in this sense. But I mean, as I said before, the text is still not fully clear, and legal departments will have to scratch their heads over it. Let me just conclude by saying that the AI Liability Directive, I don't find it particularly relevant, actually. A liability for artificial intelligence is already covered by the Product Liability Directive that has a strict liability regime, much stricter than the AI Liability Directive, which at this point we don't even know if it will happen, since the Parliament is doing an alternative impact assessment. So, you know, this is still to be seen, but actually, if it's not on your radar, Product Liability Directive is much more relevant. It will cover all type of products, including software, including AI, and probably foundation models too. So, you know, the impact that we would see coming from private enforcement, I think, would also be very relevant. And I'll close with that.
Thank you, Luca. So our time is over. So where can people find you? You can say anything, your newsletter, your blog, your social networks. So Luca, where can people find you?
You can follow my work on LinkedIn and X.
Okay, Risto?
Same, LinkedIn and X / Twitter.
And Gianclaudio?
Yeah, same, LinkedIn and X. And maybe just to say, follow also the ILO website, our research department. We have a summer school on this topic and other initiatives. So maybe just to say.
Thank you so much. And I hope to see you in the next live sessions. Bye-bye, everyone.